Hello and welcome to another episode of Put Your Socks On, or Fizzo, as it has been very affectionately known. My name is Angus Morton, and as always, I'm here with Bobby Julik. But not as always, I'm actually sitting here with Bobby Julik at Pace Ranch in Tucson, Arizona. For anybody who's been following the pod, since it began, I've been had a little issue getting back to the USA, but I'm here now, Bobby. Very good to see you in person for the first time.
Gus, you look like a million bucks, too. When you walked down the driveway, I was just like, yeah, boy, here we are. Been wondering what he looks like. You know, normally you're doing this when it's like 3 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning or after a big night out, and now we're here at this fantastic area of Tucson, Arizona, Pace Ranch. So thanks for coming all the way from Australia and finally getting your visa sorted, man.
Bobby, it's a pleasure, mate. It's good to be back and good to be with everyone. We have Nicola here as well, who's been a regular guest of the show. How you doing, Nicola?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to see you both.
Yeah, it's great to have the crew all in the one room. Let's start the show. It's been a while since, like, last time we were together, or last time we had a show was the Tour de France preview for 2020. Since then, the season's finished. All the riders have kind of gone their own separate ways. Things have quietened down. A few kind of big things in the news. But I guess the first thing I want to talk or find out about, Bobby, is, like, what happens at this time of year? What is everyone doing? We hear about the off-season. You know, I know what I used to do in the off-season. And I kind of, you know, you have an idea of what a lot of people do. Everyone thinks they go crazy. You know, they put on 10 kilos. They live a regular life. What's important about this time of year, and what's this sort of part of the season look like?
Yeah, it's a pretty special time of year because, you know, it's kind of letting the dog off the leash a little bit. You know, all of a sudden they don't have that structure in their lives and they deserve it. You know, they need to decompress a little bit. So after that last race of the year, you know, all of a sudden they're planning some vacation somewhere. They've had that on the books for a while. But the one thing that kind of jumps up and kind of delays those plans sometimes is all of a sudden that ad hoc decision to have like an informational 3-day camp for new riders joining a new team. And I always hated that because as soon as the season was over, I just wanted to get back to America because I hadn't been there in so long. And then all of a sudden you have to like delay or you have to come back just for like a 3-day informational camp. Not to say that those aren't worthwhile, but it is always like that's the first question you ask is when you're planning your vacation or your time off with your wife and your kids is you call up the GM of the team and say, are we going to have that crazy 2 or 3 day get together? And a lot of teams do that and they've done that. But then after that, man, guys are jetting all over the place and just, you know, relaxing a little bit. There's certain guys that maybe stop the season a little bit earlier than the others. So they're, you know, maybe thinking about getting back into training or they're already looking at their diet. So I always found that those little kind of pre-camps right after the season were, you know, people were on different wavelengths and they talk about like team building and get to know and get the vibe, but everyone's so tired that when they go to those things, it's kind of like, you know, just punching the clock. It's not really, you know, committing to it. But then, yeah, they go off to these places, relax, eat some things that they probably didn't allow themselves to eat. And then there's also those guys that take it as like, you know, I'm going to go and do, you know, a major detox, a major, you know, health kick thing, try something new, go for walks, you know, be super healthy, which I that wasn't me. I'd come back and it was like American football season. So I was eating nachos and hamburgers and drinking beer and staying up late and watching football games, not even thinking about touching my bike. But yeah, all these things start to trickle in. I mean, it's almost like a timer. And here we are November 7th. So there's a certain number of guys that have probably started training already. Like November 1st was always kind of like that first soft date for the guys that didn't do the Vuelta, that didn't go all the way through Lombardia. You know, they took some time off. November 1st is kind of like that period where they're looking at like, you know, I got to get back on a schedule. And then the 2nd comes, the 3rd comes, and maybe by the 5th, they're finally training again. So it is a real weird kind of transition from bookending one season and starting another one. And I think it's super super important. I always tell, you know, the athletes that I worked with and my current clients, like, you got to bookend. You got to take some time off. You got to reset. You got to get a new, totally different perspective. Otherwise, you know, the seasons are going to blend together, and that's not the best situation.
And that's, I was just going to ask you a question about that, because there is that temptation for the guys who didn't do so well, guys who, you know, maybe wanted to get a stage at the Vuelta or wanted to do well at the World Championships, Lombardia, and didn't. There's that temptation to cut your break short by a week or cut your break short by 2 weeks or, you know, kind of just not like have a soft break and keep training through because you're obviously motivated by your lack of condition or can be. What I want to know, like, the physiology of, like, what goes on in a break. Like, why is it actually important? Because, you know, I've had it drilled into me over the years always, you know, like, you're going to improve as a result of having a break. And I was always one of those people who would cut it short. What goes on, like, physiology? Why is that so important? Is it a mental thing that then transfers to a physical thing? Or?
I think it's much more of a mental thing, for sure. This is a long season, and the season keeps getting longer and longer and longer. And, you know, you can't just keep whipping a dead horse. Mm. And, you know, if you finish the season kind of on your knees and then only take, you know, an abbreviated transition period or break period, you're kind of shorting yourself because then you're starting off with those same kind of patterns, those same kind of mental images of maybe failure instead of resetting and starting from zero. That's one of my favorite sayings is, like, reset the dials, put the dials back at zero. In order to do that, it could take 2 weeks, it could take 3 weeks, it could take a month. And I always kind of set these soft targets as, like, this is where we want to start thinking about getting back into it. But if you're not there yet, I have no problem with extending it another couple days, another week. You know, yeah, if a guy's taking advantage of it and it's 5 weeks later and he's gained 10 kilos, that's an issue. But no, I think it's much more mental than physiological. You need to kind of step away, reassess, change some habits because, like, you know, habits are dangerous. You know, you get into good habits and it's great. Bad habits kind of almost get cloaked as good habits until you step away and say, what the heck was I doing? That was the worst thing I could possibly do for myself. So yeah, taking a very solid break period, yeah, which many people are doing right now. I would say, like I said earlier, November 1st, for the guys that stopped their season really early, November 15th for the guys kind of like in the middle that are kind of itching to get back at it. But, like, yeah, if you got to be training by December 1st, no matter who you are. So a lot of those guys that are starting on November 1st or November 15th, those are the guys that are going to be targeting the Tour Down Under, you know, the early spring classics where they're in a position in the team where they know they're going to be working for a leader later on. So, like, you know, try to get something from for themselves in the beginning of the season. But yeah, there's no magic number. It's got to come from you. It's just like when you're coming back from sickness or from injury. You know, guys get sick 3 days, you know, antibiotics, they're in bed. You know, the next day they say, okay, I'm good enough. I want to train. I'm like, no, take one more day and then call me and let's see where we go from there. If you still feel good, let's train. But a lot of the times it's like that mental clock that keeps ticking that is not reality. And once you give them that option of saying, no, your body has to tell you when it's time to go again, then all of a sudden, you know, they make a better decision and they come back from that sickness or injury or break period earlier.
And then talking about coming back, like, right, you know, it's December 1st, you got to start again. I guess it's the same way, like, guys get fitter or you know, people get fitter at different rates. Is there, like, a sort of, like, you know, are you sort of, like, wanting you – athletes to have 6 weeks or 8 weeks prior to a race or before that, you know, like, does it take a certain while to get back to a level? How much detraining goes on?
I think a lot of detraining goes on, but this is the time of the year that you want to work on your weaknesses. And during the season, a lot of guys don't have the energy to get into the gym, to work on their core, to work on, you know, getting more muscle in their legs or their lower back, which is going to power them during the season. So I'm not saying, you know, sit on your couch and absolutely do nothing. You know, find those activities that are relaxing to you but still kind of active. And those guys seem to come back a lot quicker because if you just sit on your couch and, I don't know, I don't know what kids do these days, play PlayStation or, you know, whatever it is.
They've been doing that for like 20 years, man. The PlayStation's been around for ages.
Well, you can tell that I never had one, so I don't
have to call you on that.
You know, yeah. And sitting there eating Toblerones and chips and drinking Coke all the
Snapchat.
Time. What's that?
That's what kids use.
Yeah, I get that from my kids all the time. But, you know, keeping those healthy habits, I think, is important. The big thing on riders' minds is gaining weight.
Yeah.
And it's the time to relax a little bit, but you don't want to go too far off the rails. But if you did the Vuelta, if you raced all the way to Lombardia, you don't have to train as hard as those guys that stopped after the Tour. Those guys that stopped after the Tour, dang, you know, that's a long off season of training, let me tell you.
Yeah, you get tired quick. And then, like, I want to talk to you about this as well, Nicola, being, like, I know with the men's teams, like, I'm talking to Lockie, my brother, and he's like, has a training camp in December, like a week-long training camp. That seems early, like... Is that normal? Was that always been
that
way?
Yes, absolutely. I think it was the way of teams keeping an eye on you.
Yeah, got you.
Making sure that you don't go totally off the rails. Because remember, back in the days, these guys would show up to Paris-Nice, which is in March, with hairy legs and like 10 kilos overweight and kind of ride themselves into the season. Now, you know, you got to start pretty much full gas to keep up with the peloton because there's, you know... Guys have more knowledge about what they're doing. They have more knowledge about their training, about their recovery, about their nutrition, and guys are hungry. So you can't let yourself go off the rails too far. And I think this was always that time where, hey, we're going to get you your new bike and we're going to, you know, kind of get you into like the training philosophy of the team and, you know, kind of just make sure that everything's kind of set. Because obviously between Christmas and New Year's, that's another kind of mini break, right? So give them a break. Let's have a training camp. Let's make sure that everything's kind of set moving forward. You know, you got all the gear and whatnot. And it's kind of funny that, you know, you go to these training camps and you can't even ride your new bike or your new clothing. Like, why is this such a thing? I remember it being so stressful. I'm like, okay, I'm at training camp in December, but I'm still riding my old crap from the year before.
Your old team's paying your wage for you to ride for the new team.
Right.
It's absurd.
And honestly, you know, don't want to get too much into this, but like, why do we have these January through December contracts? Why don't we have January through November every year?
Yeah, or November through November.
Or November through November, exactly.
Yeah, just shift the year.
Because, like, it's so odd. Like, all the guys are trying out their new bikes, their new kit. Oh, yeah, this is great. And then you have to, until like, January 1st, you know, the next day, January 1st, you wake up and you finally get to put on your new kit. You finally get to ride your new bike. But you know what? You got to race in 3 weeks. How are you going to get used to your new bike, your new position, do all this stuff if you can't be seen out there doing that? Teams have relaxed that a little bit. But at the same time, I remember, you know, I was switching teams, I won't say from which to which, and I was not happy at all with the bike, and I was just itching to get my new bike. And it just sat there. It just sat there because I'm like, man, you never know because, like, my December paycheck hasn't been paid yet. And, like, if they, you know, somebody back then, they didn't have cell phones and they couldn't, like, get you out on, you know, Instagram it. But it was always that fear that there'd be somebody from the team having a vacation in your hometown, you know, see you riding your bike and then keep your December paycheck because you violated the contract. So, yeah, there we go. Like, here we are in Fizzo saying – UCI, let's change the rules. November to November, make life a hell of a lot easier for a lot of people.
Exactly. Why not? Nicole, I wanted to ask you, is it the same in the women's peloton, a team starting with training camps in December? When, like, the season obviously starts similar time. I know in Australia, certainly, they have the Nationals and the Baycrits and that are all, like, 1st or 2nd of January. Are you guys having a camp in December?
No, we're not. No. With 50% of our team dual discipline, they're busy racing World Cups right now. So it's, you know, a very carefully crafted season, a carefully crafted road season, so we can just launch these girls into the World Cup track season. Okay. And so there is no real break. We definitely will schedule mini breaks. And right now, you know, they just had the first World Cup in Minsk.
And don't ask Bobby yeah. or myself how to pronounce that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Jennifer Valente, she got a gold medal. Chloe did in the Team Pursuit. The Team Pursuit girls did get a gold medal in the first World Cup.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Less than a year to the Olympics.
Yeah, so Emma White really stepped up, and they're looking pretty good right now heading to Tokyo. But, yeah, it's really challenging with a dual-discipline athlete to schedule the season. As you can imagine.
Yeah, so they just go, so how do you do, what's a mini break look like?
Well, Chloe right now, she came off of her world championship fitness and raced the first World Cup, and now she's taking a break for a couple of weeks. Then she'll start doing some base miles. We're trying to get at least 7 weeks of base miles in her before she does her next World Cup, which is in January. Jennifer Valente, she'll race the next two World Cups. So her schedule's a little bit different. She'll take a little bit of a break after World Championships before she goes into the road season.
Got you. And is she going to the Olympic Games as well?
Yeah. She's part of the Team Pursuit team, and she just got her first World Cup Omnium gold.
So, oh, wow. So she could be
she's
up
really,
for that as
well. Yeah, I think that, you know, she's looking really good for Tokyo as well. And then we've got the Canadian girls who they have a new coach who's from New Zealand. So they're spending 3 months in New Zealand.
Got you.
Yeah.
So it's, okay, that sounds like an absolute nightmare. And I guess it's coming into an Olympic year as well, trying to manage that mental fatigue. How do you, like, do you have assistance from the Olympic team or, like, the Olympic in terms of how you are able to manage that condition? Because I feel like you would need a lot of resources in terms of just caring for the athletes.
Yeah, I think, well, for Chloe, Kristen and I and Gary Sutton have talked about Chloe's schedule for months and months and months at this point. And so we've scheduled that out pretty perfectly for next year. So we know exactly what she's doing, exactly what road races, when her breaks are. Ben Sharp works with Jen Valente, again, talking to Sato and figuring out that perfect schedule for her. It's already been done months ago, basically. So, and then the Canadians, just working with Matt and figuring all that out. I mean, it is really challenging, but, you know, some of the girls we won't see next year from the Canadian team, maybe for one road race, but others more. So, yeah.
So outside of those girls that are obviously, you know, around the track, how do you keep in contact with them? Is it a daily text? Is it a weekly text? Is it just like saying, hey, you know, it's time to get going again? So if you don't have a training camp, how do you keep tabs on these young ladies?
We talk a lot, WhatsApp all the time. I mean, I think we're in constant communication. And then one of the other really useful tools is our weekly Zwift ride, actually, because we have most of the team, or at least half of the team, the road team, participate on our Road to Tokyo ride, which is every Thursday at 6 a.m. Pacific on Zwift. So it's actually really a useful tool for constant communication with the athletes.
Yeah, I got to witness that today, Gus. Nicola was out in the garage doing it, and she was dropping the hammer. She was kind of pushing the fence a little bit. You know, Zwift has the, you know, the fence technology, and it kept saying, you need to go back to the group. And I was like, okay, Nicola.
Really?
Had a good night of sleep last night. She was super motivated. You know, maybe it was my presence, you know, making her a little bit nervous, but she did great.
I noticed she did say it's a recovery ride. And so she's just gone out and attacked the girls on the recovery ride and get them where they're
pretty
down.
Pretty much.
They're all talking about her.
It was weird. It was definitely weird. It is a recovery social ride. And yes, I went through the fence a few times this morning.
It seems like a brilliant idea, actually.
Though. The fence?
No. I just mean like organizing a group. Like a community ride for a team.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now that I think about it, like if you just touch in once a week, it's a pretty easy way to just like.
Mm-hmm. And it builds your fan base.
We have
a global huge base that joins us. You know, sometimes it's up to almost 300 people that ride with us. Today it was 165. Yeah.
Imagine a peloton of 165. Well, you don't have to imagine. That'd be like the Tour de France riding down a public road.
Yeah.
That's pretty sick.
They stay together as a group too with the fence technology because nobody can take off. I mean, if they're gone, if they go through the fence, they've got about 50 seconds to get back in the group. Otherwise, they're gone.
Get kicked out.
They're gone. So it's his mass. Yeah, it's great. Because, we did the first ride without the fence, and it was terrible. I mean, everybody just took off, like, you know, that crazy Zwift start. And, yeah.
So maybe Fizzo should come up with a group.
We should have a group ride.
Zwift group ride. But
definitely.
I think ours would be
absolutely
1 watt per kilo and less. You know, like, you know, just
the
hey.
The fence is hard. It's a hard fence rule.
Yeah, hard fence. Hard if you hit the fence, rule. You're out.
There's no one on the fence. You're out. You're either in or you're out. Let's talk about... there's been some huge news, obviously, that's kind of we've been discussing over the last few weeks, and that's the cancellation of the Tour of California. Gutting for American cycling, gutting for global cycling, both men's and women's. I wanted to kind of, like, Bobby, you've, you know, been around since the race began. Like, what does this mean for American cycling? And then Nicola, for the women's side as well. Because it seems like it could be devastating.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's not great news when you see a race stop, and the Coors Classic stopped, and there was a big void there. Then they started the Tour de Trump, which turned into the Tour de Pont. I can't believe I just mentioned his name on the podcast, and you started laughing. And that stopped. And now, you know, we have the Tour of California stopping. I was there in 2006 for the first ever edition, and it was on all of our radars. I mean, it was that motivator to get you on your bike by November 15th because you were going to be racing in the middle of February. And all the American riders took it super serious. And back then, it wasn't World Tour. Yep. But you had a lot of the teams, you know, U.S. Postal, CSC, we were there. Just the American teams that it was kind of like the Tour de France before the Tour de France. And we were staying in the host cities were like those marquee cities in California. We were staying at amazing hotels. I remember even the first couple of years they gave these gifts to each rider. And I think the first year was like a digital camera. And when we're trying to promote this race to the Europeans, because they're like, why do I want to go all the way over to California and time change and blah, 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 and that time of year, you know? And we'd say, yeah, but you get a free digital camera. Then the next year, I think it was like an iPod, like a mini iPod. And these guys were making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year coming to the race. And basically, after the team presentation, like, hey, where's my gift? Like, it was kind of funny, right? Like, dude, it's a $99 iPod. Like, it's not the end of the world. But they really catered to us. And it was fantastic racing. And the crowds around were great. Obviously, that kind of fan base kind of peaked. Yep. And every year it was a little bit different. And, you know, European teams, especially when they changed to May, I think it changed a lot about the race. I remember the first time they changed it, one of the first years, by my memory, we started up in Lake Tahoe, which was awesome. And then we're out riding around the lake the day before. It's gorgeous. The next day it's snowing, and they had to cancel the stage. And it was just these little, like, speed bumps that just seemed to happen every year that, the race couldn't totally overcome. But then once it became World Tour, it was like, oh, man, this is going to be an issue, because that race was about showcasing the young American small teams that don't get a chance to kind of fly their flag over in Europe. And there was many, many riders that took advantage of that situation, signed pro contracts, and it was great. But once they went to World Tour, you had teams that didn't have the budget, who maybe overreached just to qualify for the race, just to be in the race. Mm. And, you know, maybe they didn't have the results that they would have had if it was kind of like a little bit more down at their level. Because when these World Tour guys come over, especially in May, they're getting ready for something. There's no one showing up there with hairy legs and 10 kilos overweight, that's for sure. Mm. And then I think the biggest change was when ASO took over the race. That seemed to me that beforehand, they were using American guys to design the courses, and they knew what places to go to, what hotels to stay at, kind of like the scenic thing. When ASO came in, I think they were just like a bean counter saying, let's get from point A to point B as quick as we can. And, you know, I remember driving the car because by that time I wasn't racing anymore. And you were going through these places that there was no one. There wasn't even like a head of cattle out there. You're like, what are we doing? You didn't have cell phone reception. Like if you went too far, you couldn't even talk to each other on the radios. So I think it was a gradual process after a big introduction. And sadly enough, you know, here we are with nothing again. And, you know, just this last year, you know, we started Fizzo as a trial during the Tour of California. And I remember one of the best things that happened was they actually implemented a national team race. So a lot of teams couldn't get in because they weren't pro continental status, but we did have a group of national team guys, just like back in the Tour de Pont days when guys, myself and guys my age got to race against Greg LeMond, Laurent Fignon, Johnny Bugno, all these guys. They had that same experience and I'm sure it meant a lot to them.
And they rode well too.
And they rode super
really well.
Well,
in the break every day, they had the jersey for a number of days in the polka dot jersey or sprint jersey. But yeah, they
super
like they rode really well, exactly.
And would that have been like the stepping stone to having maybe two national teams in the race? And instead, here we are with
no
nothing.
Race, yeah.
And I find that very, very sad. But you know, this is a sport where we struggle to get sponsorships. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, right off the bat, I would like to say a big thank you to the organization, the host cities, the sponsors that made this last, I think, 13, 14 years we had those additions.
Yep.
And without them, you know, who knows? We would have not had any race over here in America. Now we're going to have to see fill that void with something. And that's, you know, maybe another podcast or we can talk about that a little bit later on.
Yeah.
But just homage to the race that started in 2006. Americans dominated for the first 5 or 6 years. This was Levi Leipheimer's basically home race, and he just schooled everybody every year. It was pretty impressive. Then Michael Rogers finally broke that I think that was in 2010. Then you started to see like a more influx of those European guys that started taking this not only as just a vacation in February, but like in May coming over here and actually, you know, riding quite strongly. You had Gesink in 2012, TJ Van Garderen, you know, one of the highlights, I think, of his career, you know, winning a race like the Amgen Tour of California at his age, kind of like was a springboard to the European scene. Sir Bradley Wiggins won the next year after winning the Tour de France the year before. And then we got into those European guys that are household names now. Peter Sagan, like winning the overall, I mean, he was already a household name, but I mean, him winning
that
the overall in 2015, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like that was super impressive. And then the list is just like a hall of fame of, you know, basically the Tour de France right now. In 2016, we had Alaphilippe. 2017, we had George Bennett. 18, the guy who won the Tour de France this year, Egan Bernal. That. And then this year, 2019, we had Tadej Pogačar. And I think I got that right after
sounds
a thousand times saying it wrong.
Sounds right.
These are the marquee names. They came to California.
Yeah.
And it's just a shame that we don't have that anymore.
And it's the future. Like all those names that you mentioned, they were all kicking off. Like this was that race. I mean, obviously, Brad Wiggins, an outlier there, and Leipheimer, of course. But like in the recent years, they like then kicked on to do exceptional things. Like Sagan went and won the rainbow jersey 3 times in a row after that. Pogacar at the Vuelta. Alaphilippe, everyone knows what he's gone and done. He's won classics and nearly won the Tour de France. So it is a real shame. And I feel like this race, you know, as you said, going world tour, it definitely changed things on the domestic scene. And that was a really big shame. But something that it was doing really well, Nicola, was it was advancing women's cycling. And we spoke with you at the end of the race this year, and you know, like there's a lot of excitement around it. What does this mean for women's cycling, and particularly for your team, because you guys aren't a European-based team?
Yeah, well, You know, when I was living in Northern California when the Amgen Tour of California first started, and I was out there being a fan and, you know, watching the guys race, and I was very instrumental in just pushing for a women's edition. And even though it was a criterium to start with, at least it was something, because I recognized that it was such a huge media machine. Mm. And that is exactly what we needed, just to cultivate sponsorship in women's cycling. So after the first year of the criterium, it, you know, it eventually turned into an invitational time trial. And Kristen Klein from AEG was just very pivotal in making sure that a women's edition was added every single year. And then that progressed into the stage race. You know, it was an opportunity for the North American teams and the South American teams to actually show up and race against the Europeans on home turf. The rhythm of racing is very different in North America. The roads are different. The climbs are different. Everything's different. And for once, the North American teams had an advantage. And it really showed. Just the athletes that were comfortable racing on the type of roads and this type of rhythm of racing. And it really launched a lot of athletes onto European teams. I mean, take Katie Hall, for example. You know, she ended up on Bowles Dolmans. And we need those races like the Tour of California with those really great climbs like the Big Bear climb, for example. I mean, you know, Katie Hall had a great race up there. And it's otherwise, you know, the European teams aren't seeing what talent is coming out of North America. So for us, what does it mean? Really, it's, you know, as far as being a UCI team in North America, that was really the only race that we had to be UCI for, because as an elite team, you could take part in all of the other UCI teams in North America. So to be honest, especially with the Olympic year in 2020, I'm considering not being a UCI team. There's no reason for me to pay the fees. It's the only race that I needed to have a UCI license to get into. I mean, the athletes will still have UCI licenses, but to register as a UCI team seems a little bit redundant at this point. You know, perhaps there's just cachet that goes along with saying you're a UCI team in North America, but the benefits aren't there. I mean, it's almost like the UCI is irrelevant for North American racing at this point.
And I feel that to that point, like, I mean, you know, I guess probably a lot of people know my opinion on this, but I feel like the UCI is a little bit irrelevant outside of Europe. Like, I know they push as the Asia Tour, but like in Australia, we don't, you know, like we have the Tour Down Under that's World Tour, but like, I'm sorry, the same thing happened in Australia that happened in America when Tour of California went World Tour, and that was that all the domestic teams disappeared, because for their sponsors, that one race, the coverage of that race and the potential to get into that race was the value for the sponsors. Everything else was superfluous to that. So that allowed them to run a full program and allowed a bunch of other races in the country to exist.
Yes.
And it seemed to be like when that happened, it all disappeared, you know, like, and it was the same in Australia. There's barely any teams in Australia. The teams that are in Australia, they all race in Asia. Is that what we're going to see here now? Is like, are you going to be potentially forced as a result of losing this to send a team to Europe or to send a team to Asia in order to survive? Is that like, or do you think that you can do what you said, just eschew the UCI and do it your own way and do here? Because, I mean, you're obviously quite good at what you're doing.
Yeah.
Your program is working.
Yeah, I think my program is a little bit unique. I think that, you know, we're a very focused program, and with the athletes that we have on the team, our goal is Tokyo, mm-hmm. As it was Rio, as it was London. And we don't necessarily need the European racing to get to our goals, which, mm-hmm. you know, we've proved that with Chloe.
Yeah.
For example, if Chloe after this year, after 2020, says, hey, I want to do some spring classics, then yes, we'd be UCI again. But for right now, it doesn't affect us. It's not necessary. We're not traveling overseas. It costs me a whole lot less money to not be UCI. I don't have to have... What's really interesting is and I don't know if everybody knows this, but you have to provide all of your sponsor contracts right now for 2020. And, you know, as a registering as an elite team, you don't need to do that. Mm. So you can actually go out and cultivate new partners in December, in January. And, you know, it's a lot different. It's a lot more relaxed. But we'll still have our athletes, you know, with the same contracts that they've already signed. And I've spoken to them, and it doesn't matter either way to them,
yeah,
whether I'm UCI or not.
I'm a little bit concerned. Not only, obviously, we know that the Amgen Tour of California is no more, but the trickle-down effect to the other races, because, like, there always used to be a bigger draw to these races because you needed to race before Tour California, especially as a domestic team. Joe Martin comes to mind. Redlands comes to mind. It was kind of like a tick, 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 and then build up for the Tour of California. So I'm just wondering and a little bit nervous about that trickle-down effect, not only for the men, but also for the women. Are these races going to be there? Were they drafting off the Tour of California a little bit?
I think those races are well established. And, you know, every year you hear them have their struggles as well with sponsorship. But there's, you know, the race promoters in North America, it's a passion-driven endeavor, let's face it. They're not making money. And, I have a lot of respect for those individuals that run those races, but I still think they're a huge part of our schedule. I mean, even more so, you know, we definitely will be showing up to win those races next year, as will the rest of the North American teams. And South American teams are starting to come up to participate, especially in the women's peloton, at least, Joe Martin and Gila and Redlands.
Yeah. I'm a firm believer in when one door closes, another one opens. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that will be the reverse effect, and those races will be even more prestigious, and people will take them even more seriously, and we'll even have bigger fields.
Yeah, and then you've got the Colorado Classic, which really stepped up for women this year, and they're continuing next year as well. So, you know, that will be a big target race for us in 2020. That will be after the Olympics.
Yeah. So we know that one race is gone. Yeah. And, you know, obviously that's going to hurt American cycling. But we always have to look for the alternative. Like, where do we go from here? Why isn't it working? But number one is it's America. You know, we're a huge country. Europe is quite small. I mean, France is the size of Texas, for goodness sake, you know, not even to mention Belgium and Holland and Luxembourg. What can we do to get more participation in these events? I know there's a lot of great programs going on out there. NECA, for example, you know, the National Interscholastic Cycling Association. There's 31 leagues in 31 states. Tens of thousands of these kids racing on mountain bikes. What do we do when they graduate high school?
Here's the thing, Bobby. Like, there's obviously no shortage of talent in America. Like, if we look at the world championships as the result, you know, like, the U.S. dominated. You look at the NICA program, 31,000 students participating in a series of on their bikes in a series of races. Like, that's like not an insignificant number. I would love to see the statistics of scholastic programs in other nations and find anything that's even close to that. Yeah. So, like, children riding bikes, like, there's good athletes here, you know, as I said. There's some disconnect that occurs, and I think, like, if you look at NICA, it's a community, you know, like, you're at school, there's competition, but there's no money involved. And it's about nurturing, it's about exploring, it's about getting, you know, like part of the motivation to be good at that age is to win, but it's to win to be able to go across the country to see what it looks like over there and to. So I feel like there's the motivation for is kind of, I think we've got it wrong in the like professional side of the sport, particularly here in the US, in that we have to make it bigger, we have to make it harder, we have to bring more international teams. Like, going back to, you know, the Tour of California becoming a world tour race, being owned by the ASO, like, where, like, why would I, why, I mean, I'm Australian, my adopted American, but like, why am I going to care about that race when there's no competitive or hardly any competitive Americans in it? All the American teams that I like aren't allowed to race in it. So it becomes one of those things where it's like, wait, what is the point of sport? And I feel like the point of sport is to create community, to build up society, to make us better. And how do you do that? Well, you get behind the people that you know. You get behind people that you're familiar with. You know, you want a hometown hero. You want a champion, someone to champion. And I feel like these sports are getting so scattered. You know, you have an Australian team that's full of Brits, a British team that's full of Colombians. Like, you know what I mean? Like, how do we associate? How are we supposed to associate with these teams?
Good point.
And with where's the lifeblood of this sport? And I feel like the schools get it, because they have an affiliation with their school. They're racing along their school, alongside their schoolmates, against other schools. And there's a competition there, but then it ends, and then they're like, oh, I've got new friends at this school and I've seen something else in the world. So I feel like we've kind of lost sight of the point of sport, the point of what we're doing. And I hope that what's happening is that this institution that was is crumbling a little bit, and we're going to see from that rise all these new events. And we're seeing it, Dirty Cancer, GB Juro, these events that are different, that don't exist within a UCI infrastructure. They're non-professional, they're participatory, and they're inclusive, and they build a community. They're focused on they're focused on riding your bike and like competing for fun and just the challenge and the joy and the freedom that the bike brings. And so I feel like, you know, that's where the future of this sport lies. And that's certainly what I'm putting my impetus behind is, how can we fix this? How can we rediscover what this sport is? Because it's legendary, it's beautiful, it's got so much to offer, and for some reason less people are doing it. And there's no reason for that. There's no rational reason for that. And there must be something else going on. So I feel like, it lies in these new events. It lies in this new place. It lies in these kids, in programs like NICA, in the American cycling program that's obviously developing good athletes and motivating them.
Yeah. You can't tell me the sport of cycling is dead in America.
No.
I travel all around the country doing events like the Hincapie Gran Fondo, exactly. Pelotonia. And, man, it's so great. And like you said, it's a community. It's one of – that's why – having so many of these is so important. Mm. And when I see young kids get up there or women get up there, not just like the old guys like me that just like want to do it for fun, that's inspirational. But we have to find a place for those young men and women to kind of like attach to their dreams, because this sport is massive. I mean, we got gravel, we got cyclocross, we got track, we got road, we got these Gran Fondos, but like we need to get that into a little bit more organized structure so that when these kids graduate high school, they have somewhere to go. One good thing is there's a lot of collegiate teams out there that no one knows about. Guys, if you're a senior in high school right now, apply to some of these colleges and ask if they have cycling scholarships. I bet you'd be surprised how many are out there.
Get educated and get racing. It is the smartest thing you can do, for sure. That is like, that's something that America has that a lot of people don't talk about, or at least like around the world don't know. And I think that like, if you can get an education and race your bike at the same time, like, you know, you're set.
Yeah. But surrounding yourself with these people and, you know, educating yourself on training, nutrition, recovery, it's fantastic for the whole community. I see families coming to these Gran Fondos, and they come up and they take pictures and they just are so happy to be there. And, you know, the gravel events, I didn't understand the whole gravel thing. But that brings together an entirely different group of people that maybe I never would have come into contact with. And just to set the record straight, there was a little bit of fake news on VeloNews article the other day that said that Gus and myself are racing the 100-mile race down
100
here.
100 miles?
Yeah. I have to correct that right now so that people aren't like not looking right for the results. We're participating in a mass start event that happens to be on gravel. And I hope everyone's going to come out and enjoy that as much as we are. But that's it, right? Like there's that blend of, you know what? I'm not going to race this. It's not a race. I want to help the person next to me. If they're suffering or if they have a flat tire, you pull over and you help them. Like, this is community. And these events are special. And I'm blessed after retiring from the sport to get to go around to a lot of these. And each one is unique. But the bottom line is, once we put on Lycra, we're all the same. And it's a great ride, and you know, get out there and participate in these events. But let's find a way to give that conduit to those kids that are coming out of the NICA program into the professional ranks, so that they can chase their dreams that luckily my generation had, and a couple generations after that. But right now, it's kind of up in the air. We need to
and
make
they should have a fan base too, like that people know that they're out there doing it. You know, if you look back to cycling in the 80s, and there was American pros, but like, or before that maybe, in the 70s, and there was US pros, there was Australian pros, but like no one knew back home. You know what I mean? Like they might have been over there, there might have been one or two, but like nobody was paying attention back home. And that's what is fearful, because like, you know, there's obviously, like I said, or like you guys know, amazing athletes coming out of the US. They're going to go pro, but like who's going to watch them? Like, you know what I mean? Like, where's their hometown support?
Yeah.
And that's going to lead to the next generation not participating and yeah, so I think, Nicola, what do you think about for the women? Because I feel like you've been pushing for this for a long time. And then we'll wrap it up quickly.
Well, just in one sentence, most of my athletes asked for gravel bikes for 2020. So gotcha. We'll leave it at that.
There you go.
That's great.
Well, guys, thank you so much. It's fantastic to be in the same room or on the same balcony as you guys out here in Arizona. That's Fizzo. You can contact us. I forget the name. Superfan at bellanews.com. On Instagram, at that is Gus, at Bobby Julik. Nicola, you have Instagram as well. What's
at Nicola Cranmo.
Exactly. Reach out. Thank you guys for tuning in. Subscribe, all of that. Bobby, Nicola, thank you.
Thank you, Gus. Thank you, Gus. And looking forward to seeing everyone out there on the gravel this weekend. Don't check the results too hard because we'll be pretty far down. But as always, don't forget to put your socks on.
Nice.
Well, oh, what a feeling that burns down low when you ain't got nowhere to turn. Makes me feel like sometimes I'm out of control, so I'm gonna get wasted with all my country heat.